from being unable to believe I could be a surgeon to being one, a transformation that carried the force of religious conversion. She had always kept this part of my identity in mind, even when I couldn't. She had done what I had challenged myself to do as a doctor years earlier, accepted mortal responsibility for my soul, and returned me to a point where I could return to myself. I had attained the heights of the neurosurgical trainee, set to become not only a neurosurgeon, but a surgeon scientist. Every trainee aspires to this goal. Almost none make it. That night, the chairman was driving me back to my hotel after dinner. He stopped the car and pulled over. "Let me show you something," he said. We got out and stood in front of the hospital, looking over a frozen lake, its far edge luminous with specks of light leaking from faculty houses. In summer, you can swim or sail to work. In winter, you can ski or ice skate. It was like a fantasy. And in that moment, it hit me. It was a fantasy. We could never move to Wisconsin. What if I had a serious relapse in 2 years? Lucy would be isolated, stripped of her friends and family, alone, caring for a dying husband and new child. As furiously as I had tried to resist it, I realized that cancer had changed the calculus. For the last several months, I had striven with every ounce to restore my life to its pre-cancer trajectory, trying to deny cancer any purchase on my life. As desperately as I now wanted to feel triumphant, instead, I felt the claws of the crab holding me back. The curse of cancer created a strange and strained existence, challenging me to be neither blind to nor bound by death's approach. Even when the cancer was in retreat, it cast long shadows. When I'd first lost the professorship at Stanford, I'd consoled myself with the idea that running a lab made sense only on a 20-year timescale. Now I saw that this was, in fact, true. Freud started his career as a successful neuroscientist. When he realized neuroscience would need at least a century to catch up with his true ambition of understanding the mind, he set aside his microscope. I think I felt something similar. Transforming neurosurgery through my research was a gamble whose odds had been made too long by my diagnosis. The lab wasn't the place I wanted to plunk the remainder of my chips. I could hear Emma's voice again. "You have to figure out what's most important to you." If I no longer sought to fly on the highest trajectory of neurosurgeon and neuroscientist, what did I want? To be a father? To be a neurosurgeon? To teach? I didn't know. But if I did not know what I wanted, I had learned something. Something not found in Hippocrates, Maimonides, or Osler. The physician's duty is not to stave off death or return patients to their old lives, but to take into our arms a patient and family whose lives have disintegrated and work until they can stand back up and face and make sense of their own existence. My own hubris as a surgeon stood naked to me now. As much as I focused on my responsibility and power over patients' lives, it was at best a temporary responsibility, a fleeting power. Once an acute crisis has been resolved, the patient awakened, extubated, and then discharged, the patient and family go on living, and things are never quite the same. A physician's words can ease the mind, just as the neurosurgeon's scalpel can ease a disease of the brain. Yet their uncertainties and morbidities, whether emotional or physical, remain to be grappled with. Emma hadn't given me back my old identity. She'd protected my ability to forge a new one. And finally, I knew I would have to. On a crystalline spring morning on the third Sunday of Lent, Lucy and I went to church with my parents, who had flown in from Arizona for a weekend visit. We sat together in a long wooden pew, and my mother struck up a conversation with the family sitting next to us, first complimenting the mother on her baby daughter's eyes, then quickly moving on to matters of greater substance, her skills as a listener, confidant, and connector fully evident. During the pastor's scripture reading, I suddenly found myself chuckling. It featured a frustrated Jesus whose metaphorical language receives literal interpretation from his followers. Jesus answered and said to her, "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks the water I shall give will never thirst. The water I shall give will become in him a spring of water, welling up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water, so that I may not be thirsty or have to keep coming here to draw water." Meanwhile, the disciples urged him, "Rabbi, eat!" But he said to them, "I have food to eat of which you do not know." So the disciples said to one another, "Could someone have brought him something to eat?" It was passages like these, where there is a clear mocking of literalist readings of Scripture, that had brought me back around to Christianity after a long stretch. Following college, when my notion of God and Jesus had grown, to put it gently, tenuous. During my sojourn in ironclad atheism, the primary arsenal leveled against Christianity had been its failure on empirical grounds. Surely enlightened reason offered a more coherent cosmos. Surely Occam's razor cut the faithful free from blind faith. There is no proof of God, therefore it is unreasonable to believe in God. Although I had been raised in a devout Christian family, where prayer and scripture readings were a nightly ritual, I, like most scientific types, came to believe in the possibility of a material conception of reality, an ultimately scientific worldview that would grant a complete metaphysics, minus outmoded concepts like souls, God, and bearded white men in robes. I spent a good chunk of my 20s trying to build a frame for such an endeavor. The problem, however, eventually became evident. To make science the arbiter of metaphysics is to banish not only God from the world, but also love, hate, meaning. To consider a world that is self-evidently not the world we live in. That's not to say that if you believe in meaning, you must also believe in God. It is to say, though, that if you believe that science provides no basis for God, then you are almost obligated to conclude that science provides no basis for meaning, and therefore life itself doesn't have any. In other words, existential claims have no weight. All knowledge is scientific knowledge. Yet the paradox is that scientific methodology is the product of human hands, and thus cannot reach some permanent truth. We build scientific theories to organize and manipulate the world, to reduce phenomena into manageable units. Science is based on reproducibility and manufactured objectivity. As strong as that makes its ability to generate claims about matter and energy, it also makes scientific knowledge inapplicable to the existential, visceral nature of human life, which is unique and subjective and unpredictable. Science may provide the most useful way to organize empirical, reproducible data, but its power to do so is predicated on its inability to grasp the most central aspects of human life: hope, fear, love, hate, beauty, envy, honor, weakness, striving, suffering, virtue. Between these core passions and scientific theory, there will always be a gap. No system of thought can contain the fullness of human experience. The realm of metaphysics remains the province of revelation. This, not atheism, is what Occam argued, after all. And atheism can be justified only on these grounds. The prototypical atheist, then, is Graham Greene's commandant from The Power and the Glory, whose atheism comes from a revelation of the absence of God. The only real atheism must be grounded in a world-making vision. The favorite quote of many an atheist, from the Nobel Prize-winning French biologist Jacques Monod, belies this revelatory aspect. The ancient covenant is in pieces. Man at last knows that he is alone in the unfeeling immensity of the universe, out of which he emerged only by chance. Yet I returned to the central values of Christianity, sacrifice, redemption, forgiveness, because I found them so compelling. There is a tension in the Bible between justice and mercy, between the Old Testament and the New Testament. And the New Testament says you can never be good enough. Goodness is the thing, and you can never live up to it. The main message of Jesus, I believed, is that mercy trumps justice every time. Not only that, but maybe the basic message of original sin isn't feel guilty all the time. Maybe it is more along these lines. We all have a notion of what it means to be good, and we can't live up to it all the time. Maybe that's what the message of the New Testament is after all. Even if you have a notion as well defined as Leviticus, you can't live that way. It's not just impossible. It's insane. About God, I could say nothing definitive, of course, but the basic reality of human life stands compellingly against blind determinism. Moreover, no one, myself included, credits revelation with any epistemic authority. We are all reasonable people. Revelation is not good enough. Even if God spoke to us, we'd discount it as delusional. So what, I wonder, is the aspiring metaphysician to do? Give up? Almost. Struggle toward the capital T truth, but recognize that the task is impossible, or that if a correct answer is possible, verification certainly is impossible. In the end, it cannot be doubted that each of us can see only a part of the picture. The doctor sees one, the patient another, the engineer a third, the economist a fourth, the pearl diver a fifth, the alcoholic a sixth, the cable guy a seventh, the sheep farmer an eighth, the Indian beggar a ninth, the pastor a tenth. Human knowledge is never contained in one person. It grows from the relationships we create between each other and the world, and still, it is never complete. And truth comes somewhere above all of them, where, as at the end of that Sunday's reading, the sower and reaper can rejoice together. For here the saying is verified that one sows and another reaps. I sent you to reap what you have not worked for. Others have done the work, and you are sharing the fruits of their work. I hopped out of the CT scanner, 7 months since I had returned to surgery. This would be my last scan before finishing residency, before becoming a father, before my future became real. "Want to take a look, Doc?" the tech said. "Not right now," I said. "I've got a lot of work to do today." It was already 6 p.m. I had to go see patients, organize tomorrow's OR schedule, review films, dictate my clinic notes, check on my post-ops, and so on. Around 8 p.m., I sat down in the neurosurgery office, next to a radiology viewing station. I turned it on, looked at my patient's scans for the next day, two simple spine cases, and finally typed in my own name. I zipped through the images as if they were a kid's flipbook, comparing the new scan to the last. Everything looked the same, The old tumors remained exactly the same.
Except wait. I rolled back the images, looked again. There it was. A new tumor, large, filling my right middle lobe. It looked, oddly, like a full moon having almost cleared the horizon. Going back to the old images, I could make out the faintest trace of it, a ghostly harbinger now brought fully into the world. I was neither angry nor scared. It simply was. It was a fact about the world, like the distance from the sun to the earth. I drove home and told Lucy. It was a Thursday night, and we wouldn't see Emma again until Monday. But Lucy and I sat down in the living room with our laptops and mapped out the next steps. Biopsies, tests, chemotherapy. The treatments this time around would be tougher to endure. The possibility of a long life more remote. Elliot again. But at my back in a cold blast I hear the rattle of the bones and chuckle spread from ear to ear. Neurosurgery would be impossible for a couple of weeks, perhaps months, perhaps forever. But we decided that all of that could wait to be real until Monday. Today was Thursday. And I'd already made tomorrow's OR assignments. I'd planned on having one last day as a resident. As I stepped out of my car at the hospital at 5:20 the next morning, I inhaled deeply, smelling the eucalyptus and... Was that pine? Hadn't noticed that before. I met the resident team, assembled for morning rounds. We reviewed overnight events, new admissions, new scans. Then went to see our patients before M&M, or Morbidity and Mortality Conference, a regular meeting in which the neurosurgeons gathered to review mistakes that had been made and cases that had gone wrong. Afterward, I spent an extra couple of minutes with the patient, Mr. R. He had developed a rare syndrome called Gerstmann's, where, after I'd removed his brain tumor, he'd begun showing several specific deficits, an inability to write, to name fingers, to do arithmetic, to tell left from right. I'd seen it only once before, as a medical student 8 years ago, on one of the first patients I'd followed on the neurosurgical service. Like him, Mr. R. was euphoric. I wondered if that was part of the syndrome that no one had described before. Mr. R. was getting better, though. His speech had returned almost to normal, and his arithmetic was only slightly off. He'd likely make a full recovery. The morning passed, and I scrubbed for my last case. Suddenly, the moment felt enormous. My last time scrubbing? Perhaps this was it. I watched the suds drip off my arms, then down the drain. I entered the OR, gowned up, and draped the patient, making sure the corners were sharp and neat. I wanted this case to be perfect. I opened the skin of his lower back. He was an elderly man whose spine had degenerated, compressing his nerve roots and causing severe pain. I pulled away the fat until the fascia appeared, and I could feel the tips of his vertebra. I opened the fascia and smoothly dissected the muscle away, until only the wide, glistening vertebra showed up through the wound, clean and bloodless. The attending wandered in as I began to remove the lamina, the back wall of the vertebra, whose bony overgrowths, along with ligaments beneath, were compressing the nerves.
"Looks good," he said. "If you want to go to today's conference, I can have the fellow come in and finish."
My back was beginning to ache. Why hadn't I taken an extra dose of NSAIDs beforehand? This case should be quick, though. I was almost there.
"Nah," I said. "I want to finish the case."
The attending scrubbed in, and together we completed the bony removal. He began to pick away at the ligaments, beneath which lay the dura, which contained spinal fluid and the nerve roots. The most common error at this stage is tearing a hole in the dura. I worked on the opposite side. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw near his instrument a flash of blue. The dura started to peek through.
"Watch out," I said,
just as the mouth of his instrument bit into the dura.
Clear spinal fluid began to fill the wound.
I hadn't had a leak in one of my cases in more than a year. Repairing it would take another hour.
"Get the micro set out," I said. "We have a leak."
By the time we finished the repair and removed the compressive soft tissue, my shoulders burned. The attending broke scrub, offered his apologies, and said his thanks, and left me to close. The layers came together nicely. I began to suture the skin, using a running nylon stitch. Most surgeons use staples, but I was convinced that nylon had lower infection rates, and we would do this one, this final closure, my way. The skin came together perfectly, without tension, as if there had been no surgery at all.
Good. One good thing.
As we uncovered the patient, the scrub nurse, one with whom I hadn't worked before, said,
"You on call this weekend, Doc?"
"Nope. And possibly never again."
"Got any more cases today?"
"Nope. And possibly never again."
"Shit. Well, I guess that means this is a happy ending. Work's done. I like happy endings. Don't you, Doc?"
"Yeah. Yeah, I like happy endings." I sat down by the computer to enter orders as the nurses cleaned and the anesthesiologists began to wake the patient. I had always jokingly threatened that when I was in charge, instead of the high-energy pop music everyone liked to play in the OR, we'd listen exclusively to bossa nova. I put Getz Gilberto on the radio, and the soft, sonorous sounds of a saxophone filled the room. I left the OR shortly after, then gathered my things, which had accumulated over 7 years of work. Extra sets of clothes for the nights you don't leave, toothbrushes, bars of soap, phone chargers, snacks, my skull model and collection of neurosurgery books, and so on. On second thought, I left my books behind. They'd be of more use here. On my way out to the parking lot, a fellow approached to ask me something, but his pager went off. He looked at it, waved, turned, and ran back into the hospital. "I'll catch you later," he called over his shoulder. Tears welled up as I sat in the car, turned the key, and slowly pulled out into the street. I drove home, walked through the front door, hung up my white coat, and took off my ID badge. I pulled the battery out of my pager. I peeled off my scrubs and took a long shower. Later that night, I called Victoria and told her I wouldn't be in on Monday, or possibly ever again, and wouldn't be setting the OR schedule.
"You know, I've been having this recurring nightmare that this day was coming," she said. "I don't know how you did this for so long."
Lucy and I met with Emma on Monday. She confirmed the plan we'd envisioned. Bronchoscopic biopsy. Look for targetable mutations. Otherwise, chemo. The real reason I was there, though, was for her guidance. I told her I was taking leave from neurosurgery.
"Okay," she said. "That's fine. You can stop neurosurgery if, say, you want to focus on something that matters more to you. But not because you are sick. You aren't any sicker than you were a week ago. This is a bump in the road, but you can keep your current trajectory. Neurosurgery was important to you."
Once again, I had traversed the line from doctor to patient, from actor to acted upon, from subject to direct object. My life up until my illness could be understood as the linear sum of my choices. As in most modern narratives, a character's fate depended on human actions, his and others, King Lear's Gloucester may complain about human fate as flies to wanton boys, but it's Lear's vanity that sets in motion the dramatic arc of the play. From the Enlightenment onward, the individual occupied center stage. But now I lived in a different world, a more ancient one, where human action paled against superhuman forces, a world that was more Greek tragedy than Shakespeare. No amount of effort can help Oedipus and his parents escape their fates. Their only access to the forces controlling their lives is through the oracles and seers, those given divine vision. What I had come for was not a treatment plan. I had read enough to know the medical ways forward, but the comfort of oracular wisdom. "This is not the end," she said, a line she must have used a thousand times. After all, did I not use similar speeches to my own patients, to those seeking impossible answers, or even the beginning of the end? This is just the end of the beginning. And I felt better. A week after the biopsy, Alexis, the nurse practitioner, called. There were no new targetable mutations, so chemotherapy was the only option, and it was being set up for Monday. I asked about the specific agents and was told I'd have to talk to Emma. She was en route to Lake Tahoe with her kids, but she'd give me a call over the weekend. The next day, a Saturday, Emma called. I asked her what she thought about chemotherapy agents. "Well," she said, "do you have specific thoughts?" "I guess the main question is whether to include Avastin," I said. "I know the data is mixed and that it adds potential side effects, and some cancer centers are turning away from it. In my mind, though, since there are a lot of studies supporting its use, I'd lean toward including it. We can discontinue it if I have a bad reaction to it, if that seems sensible to you."
"Yeah, that sounds about right. Insurance companies also make it hard to add it later, so that's another reason to use it up front."
"Thanks for calling. I'll let you get back to enjoying the lake."
"Okay, but there's one thing." She paused. "I'm totally happy for us to make your medical plan together. Obviously, you're a doctor. You know what you're talking about, and it's your life. But if you ever want me to just be the doctor, I'm happy to do that too." I hadn't ever considered that I could release myself from the responsibility of my own medical care. I just assumed all patients became experts at their own diseases. I remembered how, as a green medical student, knowing nothing, I would often end up asking patients to explain their diseases and treatments to me, their blue toes and pink pills. But as a doctor, I never expected patients to make decisions alone. I bore responsibility for the patient, and I realized I was trying to do the same thing now, my doctor self remaining responsible for my patient self. Maybe I'd been cursed by a Greek god, but abdicating control seemed irresponsible, if not impossible. Chemotherapy began on Monday. Lucy, my mother, and I went to the infusion center together. I had an IV placed, settled into an easy chair, and waited. The drug cocktail would take 4.5 hours to infuse. I passed the time napping, reading, and sometimes blankly staring, with Lucy and my mother next to me, interrupting the silence with occasional small talk. The other occupants of the room were in various states of health, some bald, some well-coiffed, some withered, some sprightly, some disheveled, some dapper. All lay still, silent, with IV tubing dripping poison into outstretched arms. I was to return every 3 weeks for treatment. I began to feel the effects the next day, a deep fatigue, a profound bone weariness setting in. Eating, normally a source of great pleasure, was like drinking seawater.
Suddenly, all of my joys were salted. For breakfast, Lucy made me a bagel with cream cheese. It tasted like a salt lick. I set it aside. Reading was exhausting. I had agreed to write a few chapters on the therapeutic potential of my research with V for 2 major neurosurgical textbooks. That, too, I set aside. The days passed, television and forced feedings marking the time. A pattern developed over the weeks. The malaise would slowly ease, normalcy returning just in time for the next treatment. The cycles continued. I shuffled in and out of the hospital with minor complications, which were just enough to preclude any return to work. The neurosurgery department determined that I had met all national and local criteria for graduation. The ceremony was scheduled for a Saturday, about 2 weeks before Lucy's due date. The day arrived. As I stood in our bedroom, dressing for graduation, the culmination of 7 years of residency, a piercing nausea struck me. This was unlike the usual nausea of chemotherapy, which washed over you like a wave and, like a wave, could be ridden. I began uncontrollably vomiting green bile, its chalky taste distinct from stomach acid. This was from deep in my gut. I would not be going to graduation after all. I needed IV fluids to avoid dehydration, so Lucy drove me to the emergency department and rehydration began. The vomiting gave way to diarrhea. The medical resident, Brad, and I chatted amicably, and I relayed my medical history, covering all my medications, and we ended up discussing advances in molecular therapies, especially Tarceva, which I was still taking. The medical plan was simple. Keep me hydrated with intravenous fluids until I could drink enough by mouth. That evening, I was admitted to a hospital room. But when the nurse reviewed my medication list, I noticed Tarceva was not on it. I asked her to call the resident to correct the oversight. These things happen. I was taking 12 medications, after all. Keeping track was not easy. It was well past midnight when Brad appeared. "I heard you had a question about your medications?" he asked. "Yeah," I said. "Tarceva wasn't ordered. Do you mind ordering it?" "I decided to take you off it." "Why is that?" "Your liver enzymes are too high to take it." I was confused. My liver enzymes had been high for months. If this was an issue, why hadn't we discussed it before? In any case, this was clearly a mistake. "Emma, my oncologist, your boss, has seen these numbers and she wants to keep me on it." Residents routinely have to make medical decisions without the attending's input. But now that he had Emma's opinion, surely he would capitulate. "But it might be causing your GI problems." My confusion deepened. Usually invoking the attending's orders ends the discussion. "I've been taking it for a year without any problems," I said. "You think Tarceva is causing this all of a sudden, and not the chemotherapy?"
"Maybe, yeah."
Confusion yielded to anger. Some kid, 2 years out of med school, no older than my junior residents, was really arguing with me? It'd be one thing if he were right, but he wasn't making any sense.
"Didn't I mention this afternoon that without that pill, my bone metastases become active and produce excruciating pain? I don't mean to sound dramatic, but I've broken bones boxing, and this is far more painful. As in, 10 out of 10 pain. As in, I will actually soon be screaming pain."
"Well, given the half-life of the drug, that probably won't happen for a day or so." I could see that in Brad's eyes, I was not a patient. I was a problem, a box to be checked off.
"Look," he continued, "if you weren't you, we wouldn't even be having this conversation. I'd just stop the drug and make you prove it causes all this pain."
What had happened to our amicable chat this afternoon?
I thought back to med school, when a patient had told me that she always wore her most expensive socks to the doctor's office, so that when she was in a patient's gown and shoeless, the doctor would see the socks and know she was a person of substance, to be treated with respect.
Ah, there's the problem. I was wearing hospital-issue socks, which I had been stealing for years.
Anyway, Tarceva is a special drug, and it requires a fellow or attending to sign off on it. Do you really want me to wake someone up for this? Can't it wait till morning?
And there it was. Meeting his obligation to me meant adding one more thing to his to-do list. An embarrassing phone call with his boss, revealing his error. He was working the night shift. Residency education regulations had forced most programs to adopt shift work. And along with shift work comes a kind of shiftiness, a subtle undercutting of responsibility. If he could just push it off for a few more hours, I would become somebody else's problem.
I usually take it at 5 a.m., I said, and you know as well as I do that waiting till morning means letting someone deal with it after morning rounds, which will be more like the afternoon. Right?
Okay, fine, he said, and left the room.
When morning arrived, I discovered that he had not ordered the medication. Emma dropped in to say hello and told me she would sort out the Tarceva order. She wished me a speedy recovery and apologized for the fact that she was heading out of town for a week. Over the course of the day, I began to deteriorate, my diarrhea rapidly worsening. I was being rehydrated, but not quickly enough. My kidneys began to fail. My mouth became so dry I could not speak or swallow. At the next lab check, my serum sodium had reached a near fatal level. I was transferred to the ICU. Part of my soft palate and pharynx died from dehydration and peeled out of my mouth. I was in pain, floating through varying levels of consciousness, while a pantheon of specialists was brought together to help. Medical intensivists, nephrologists, gastroenterologists, endocrinologists, infectious disease specialists, neurosurgeons, general oncologists, thoracic oncologists, otolaryngologists. Lucy, 38 weeks pregnant, stayed with me by day and secretly moved into my old call room, steps from the ICU, so she could check on me at night. She and my father also lent their voices. During lucid moments, I was acutely aware that with this many voices, cacophony results. In medicine, this is known as the white ghost problem. Who is the captain of the ship? The nephrologists disagreed with the ICU doctors, who disagreed with the endocrinologists, who disagreed with the oncologists, who disagreed with the gastroenterologists. I felt the responsibility of my care. During bouts of consciousness, I typed out the sequential details of my current illness and, with Lucy's help, tried to corral all the doctors to keep the facts and interpretations straight. Later, while half asleep, I could dimly hear my father and Lucy discussing my condition with each team of doctors. We suspected that the main plan should just be to treat me with fluids until the effects of the chemotherapy wore off. But each group of specialists had to allow for more esoteric possibilities and advocate tests and treatments for them, some of which seemed unnecessary and ill-advised. Samples were taken, scans were ordered, medications were given. I began losing track of events and time. I requested that these plans be explained to me, but sentences would become slippery, voices would dampen and muffle, and darkness would descend in the midst of doctor speeches as I wobbled in and out of coherence. I desperately wished Emma were there, in charge. Suddenly, she appeared.
"You're back already?" I said.
"You've been in the ICU for over a week," she said. "But don't worry, you're getting better. Most of your labs have normalized. You'll be out of here soon." She'd been in touch with my doctors over email, I learned.
You know how you offered to just be the doctor and I could just be the patient? I asked.
I think that's maybe a good idea.
I've been reading science and literature, trying to find the right perspective, but I haven't found it.
I'm not sure that's something you can find by reading about it, she replied.
Emma was now the captain of the ship, lending a sense of calm to the chaos of this hospitalization.
T.S. Eliot sprang to mind.
Damyata. The boat responded gaily to the hand expert with sail and oar. The sea was calm. Your heart would have responded gaily when invited, beating obedient to controlling hands.
I leaned back in my hospital bed and closed my eyes. As the darkness of delirium descended again, I finally relaxed.
Lucy's due date came and went without labor, and I was finally scheduled to be discharged from the hospital. I had lost over 40 pounds since being diagnosed, 15 in the last week. I weighed as much as I had in 8th grade, though my hair had considerably thinned since those days, mostly in the past month. I was awake again, alert to the world, but withered. I could see my bones against my skin, a living X-ray. At home, simply holding my head up was tiring. Lifting a glass of water required both hands. Reading was out of the question. Both sets of parents were in town to help. 2 days after discharge, Lucy had her first contractions. She stayed home while my mother drove me to my follow-up appointment with Emma.
Frustrated? Emma asked.
No.
You should be. It's going to be a long recovery.
Well, yes, okay, I am frustrated on the big picture. But on the day-to-day, I'm ready to get back to physical therapy and start recovering. I did it once, so it should be old hat, right?
Did you see your last scan? She asked.
No.
I've kind of stopped looking. It looks good, she said. The disease looks stable, maybe even slightly shrinking.
We talked through some of the coming logistics. Chemotherapy would be on hold until I was stronger. Experimental trials wouldn't accept me in my current state either. Treatment wasn't an option. Not until I regained some strength. I leaned my head against the wall to support the flagging muscles of my neck. My thoughts were clouded. I needed that oracle to scry again, to gather secrets from birds or star charts, from mutant genes or Kaplan-Meier graphs.
Emma, I said, what's the next step? Get stronger. That's it.
But when the cancer recurs, I mean, the probabilities...
I paused.
First-line therapy, Tarceva, had failed. Second-line therapy, chemo, had nearly killed me. Third-line therapy, if I could even get there, made few promises. Beyond that, the vast unknown of experimental treatments.
Phrases of doubt fell from my mouth.
I mean, getting back to the OR, or to walking, or even...
You have 5 good years left, she said.
She pronounced it, but without the authoritative tone of an oracle, without the confidence of a true believer. She said it, instead, like a plea. Like that patient who could speak only in numbers. Like she was not so much speaking to me as pleading, a mere human, with whatever forces and fates truly controlled these things. There we were, doctor and patient, in a relationship that sometimes carries a magisterial air, and other times, like now, was no more
and no less than two people huddled together as one faces the abyss. Doctors, it turns out, need hope too. On the way home from the appointment with Emma, Lucy's mom called to say they were headed to the hospital. Lucy was in labor. "Make sure you ask about the epidural early," I told her. She had suffered enough. I returned to the hospital, pushed by my father in a wheelchair. I lay down on a cot in the delivery room, heat packs and blankets keeping my skeletal body from shivering. For the next 2 hours, I watched Lucy and the nurse go through the ritual of labor. As a contraction built up, the nurse counted off the pushing. "And a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and a 10. Lucy turned to me, smiling. "It feels like I'm playing a sport," she said. I lay on the cot and smiled back, watching her belly rise. There would be so many absences in Lucy's and my daughter's life. If this was as present as I could be, then so be it. Sometime after midnight, the nurse nudged me awake. "It's almost time," she whispered. She gathered the blankets and helped me to a chair next to Lucy. The obstetrician was already in the room, no older than I. She looked up at me as the baby was crowning. "I can tell you one thing. Your daughter has hair exactly like yours," she said, "and a lot of it." I nodded, holding Lucy's hand during the last moments of her labor. And then, with one final push, on July 4th, at 2:11 a.m., there she was. Elizabeth Acadia. Katie. We had picked the name months before. "Can we put her on your skin, Papa?" the nurse asked me. "No, I'm too cold, I said, my teeth chattering. "But I would love to hold her." They wrapped her in blankets and handed her to me. Feeling her weight in one arm and gripping Lucy's hand with the other, the possibilities of life emanated before us. The cancer cells in my body would still be dying, or they'd start growing again. Looking out over the expanse ahead, I saw not an empty wasteland, but something simpler. A blank page on which I would go on. Yet there is dynamism in our house. Day to day, week to week, Katie blossoms. A first grasp, a first smile, a first laugh. Her pediatrician regularly records her growth on charts, tick marks indicating her progress over time. A brightening newness surrounds her. As she sits in my lap, smiling, enthralled by my tuneless singing, an incandescence lights the room. Time for me is now double-edged. Every day brings me further from the low of my last relapse, but closer to the next recurrence, and eventually, death. Perhaps later than I think, but certainly sooner than I desire. There are, I imagine, two responses to that realization. The most obvious might be an impulse to frantic activity, to live life to its fullest, to travel, to dine, to achieve a host of neglected ambitions. Part of the cruelty of cancer, though, is not only that it limits your time, it also limits your energy, vastly reducing the amount you can squeeze into a day. It is a tired hare who now races, and even if I had the energy, I prefer a more tortoise-like approach. I plod. I ponder. Some days, I simply persist. If time dilates when one moves at high speeds, does it contract when one moves barely at all? It must. The days have shortened considerably. with little to distinguish one day from the next, time has begun to feel static. In English, we use the word time in different ways. The time is 2:45 versus I'm going through a tough time. These days, time feels less like the ticking clock and more like a state of being. Languor settles in. There's a feeling of openness. As a surgeon focused on a patient in the OR, I might have found the position of the clock's hands arbitrary, but I never thought them meaningless. Now, the time of day means nothing. The day of the week, scarcely more. Medical training is relentlessly future-oriented, all about delayed gratification. You're always thinking about what you'll be doing 5 years down the line. But now, I don't know what I'll be doing 5 years down the line. I may be dead. I may not be. I may be healthy. I may be writing. I don't know. And so, it's not all that useful to spend time thinking about the future. That is, beyond lunch. Verb conjugation has become muddled as well. Which is correct? I am a neurosurgeon? I was a neurosurgeon? Or, I had been a neurosurgeon before and will be again? Graham Greene once said that life was lived in the first 20 years, and the remainder was just reflection. So what tense am I living in now? Have I proceeded beyond the present tense and into the past perfect? The future tense seems vacant and, on others' lips, jarring. A few months ago I celebrated my 15th college reunion at Stanford and stood out on the quad, drinking a whiskey as a pink sun dipped below the horizon. When old friends called out parting promises, "We'll see you at the 25th. It seemed rude to respond with, "Well, probably not." Everyone succumbs to finitude. I suspect I am not the only one who reaches this pluperfect state. Most ambitions are either achieved or abandoned. Either way, they belong to the past. The future, instead of the ladder toward the goals of life, flattens out into a perpetual present. Money, status, all the vanities the preacher of Ecclesiastes described hold so little interest, a chasing after wind indeed. Yet one thing cannot be robbed of her futurity. Our daughter, Katie. I hope I'll live long enough that she has some memory of me. Words have a longevity I do not. I had thought I could leave her a series of letters, but what would they say? I don't know what this girl will be like when she is 15. I don't even know if she'll take to the nickname we've given her. There is perhaps only one thing to say to this infant, who is all future, overlapping briefly with me, whose life, barring the improbable, is all but past. That message is simple. When you come to one of the many moments in life where you must give an account of yourself, provide a ledger of what you have been and done and meant to the world, do not, I pray, discount that you filled a dying man's days with a sated joy, a joy unknown to me in all my prior years, a joy that does not hunger for more and more, but rests, satisfied. In this time, right now, that is an enormous thing.
Epilogue. Lucy Kalanithi. You left me, sweet, two legacies. A legacy of love, a heavenly father would content had he the offer of. You left me boundaries of pain, capacious as the sea, between eternity and time, your consciousness and me. Emily Dickinson. Paul died on Monday, March 9th, 2015, surrounded by his family, in a hospital bed roughly 200 yards from the labor and delivery ward, where our daughter, Katie, had entered the world 8 months before. Between Katie's birth and Paul's death, if you'd seen us sucking on ribs at our local barbecue restaurant and smiling over a shared beer, a dark-haired baby with long eyelashes napping in her stroller beside us, you'd never have guessed that Paul likely had less than a year to live, nor that we understood that. It was around Katie's first Christmas, when she was 5 months old, that Paul's cancer began to resist the third-line drugs recommended after Tarceva and then chemotherapy had stopped working. Katie tried her first solid food during that holiday season, snug in candy cane striped pajamas, gumming mashed yams as family gathered at Paul's childhood home in Kingman, Arizona, the house aglow with candles and chatter. His strength waned over the following months, but we continued to experience joyful moments, even in the midst of our sorrow. We hosted cozy dinner parties, held each other at night, and delighted in our daughter's bright eyes and calm nature. And, of course, Paul wrote, reclining in his armchair, wrapped in a warm fleece blanket. In his final months, he was singularly focused on finishing this book. As winter turned to spring, the saucer magnolias in our neighborhood bloomed large and pink, but Paul's health was declining rapidly. By late February, he needed supplemental oxygen to keep his breathing comfortable. I was adding his untouched lunch to the trash can atop his untouched breakfast, and a few hours later I'd add an untouched dinner to the pile. He used to love my breakfast sandwiches, egg, sausage, and cheese on a roll. But with his waning appetite, we'd change to eggs and toast, then just eggs, until even those became intolerable. Even his favorite smoothies, the glasses I filled with a steady stream of calories, were unappetizing. Bedtime crept earlier, Paul's voice slurred intermittently, and his nausea became unremitting. A CT scan and brain MRI confirmed worsening cancer in Paul's lungs and new tumors that had landed in his brain, including leptomeningeal carcinomatosis, a rare and lethal infiltration that brought with it a prognosis of only several months and the looming shadow of swift neurologic decline. The news hit Paul hard. He said little, but as a neurosurgeon, he knew what lay ahead. Although Paul accepted his limited life expectancy, neurologic decline was a new devastation, the prospect of losing meaning and agency agonizing. We strategized with Paul's oncologist about his top priority, preserving mental acuity as long as possible. We arranged entry into a clinical trial, consultation with a neuro-oncology specialist, and a visit with his palliative care team to discuss hospice options, all in service of maximizing the quality of his remaining time. My heart swelled, even as I steeled myself, anticipating his suffering, worrying that he had only weeks left, if that. I envisioned his funeral as we held hands. I didn't know that Paul would die within days. We spent Paul's last Saturday with family in the nest of our living room, Paul holding Katie in his armchair, his father on my nursing glider, his mother and I on sofas nearby. Paul sang to Katie and bounced her gently in his lap. She grinned widely, oblivious to the tubing that delivered oxygen to his nose. His world became smaller. I deflected non-family visitors, Paul telling me, "I want everyone to know that even if I don't see them, I love them. I cherish their friendship, and one more glass of Ardbeg won't change that." He didn't write anything that day. The manuscript for this book was only partially finished, and Paul now knew that he was unlikely to complete it, unlikely to have the stamina.